You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, we talk to a Wisconsin sheriff about a nationwide effort to stop drunk driving. First, when we screw up and we fail, most people have a tendency to dwell on their mistakes. And as humans, we tend to think negatively in many aspects of our lives, ranging from regrets to high expectations. But new research shows that we actually could benefit from a little kindness from ourselves. And learning to be kind to ourselves can have a remarkable effect on our happiness. Joining us now to talk about this is Mark Leary. He's a professor of psychology and neuroscience at Duke University, and he recently wrote an article for the online magazine Eon called Don't Beat Yourself Up. Mark, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
Well, your piece about being kind to yourself, you start off by saying that humans are really the only animal that specializes in making themselves miserable. What do we know about why that is?
Well, human beings are the only animals that can think consciously about themselves. And so we can think about ourselves in negative ways. We can look into the future and begin to dread and worry about what's happening in ways that other animals can't. They react to the bad events that happen right in the moment. But as long as they're safe in their burrows, they're not lying there awake all night long the way that we are, tossing and turning in bed, worrying about the next day.
And why do people dwell on their mistakes?
Well, we really don't know, but we think it's probably because when you make a mistake, it's probably better to assume in one way that it's more serious than it really is. That is, it's better to take something very seriously than to overlook the possibility that you did something very negative or very badly and aren't paying attention to it. So we seem to have a built-in bias to be harder on ourselves than we really need to be, than we really need to be from a realistic sense. Things are usually not as bad as we think they are.
Mark Leary is with us right now. He's a professor of psychology and neuroscience at Duke University. And we're talking about why research shows that being kind to ourselves is actually a lot more beneficial than being tough on ourselves. It has a good effect on our happiness and our sense of well-being. And we want to hear from you on this. Do you find it difficult to be kind to yourself? Or maybe you've been working on being kind to yourself and you've got some advice for the rest of us. Tell us what you've learned and how it works. Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. What is it like when you're kind to yourself? 800-642-1234. Do you think there's anything that's maybe uniquely American about being hard on ourselves? Do Americans like to beat themselves up when things go badly? And why is that? Is it possible to turn this equation around? There is research out there showing that, yeah, we can be happier, we can be healthier, we can have a better sense of well-being if we'd only learn how to be kind. And interesting stuff there, too. When we're kind to ourselves, we process it as though a friend is being kind to us. We get that same level of benefit with that friendship. So let us know what you think at 800-642-1234. And we're working on getting Mark Leary back with us, again, professor of psychology at Duke University. And we'll see if he's back with us. Mark, are you there?
I am here. Can you hear me?
I can hear you pretty well. A little soft, but I think our listeners will be able to catch what you're saying there. And Mark, tell us about some of this research about why these days it seems like focusing on kindness to ourselves is supplanting what we used to think about having positive self-esteem.
Well, for many years, we believed that self-esteem was really important, which it is. People want to feel good about themselves and evaluate themselves positively. But it's much more important to treat yourself kindly and compassionately the way you would treat a loved one. The irony is most of us are far meaner to ourselves in our own minds than we would ever be toward people that we care about. And it's just interesting to think about dealing with yourself the same way that you would deal with other people when they have problems, to reduce the blame and the criticism and the negativity. And if you do that, it produces the same kind of positive effects it produces on loved ones when we show them compassion.
Can we be specific about what it means to be kind to ourselves? I think I know what that means, but if I'm actually in that moment, what am I doing to be kind to myself?
You're simply being supportive. It's not positive thinking. It's not just saying everything is okay, you're a wonderful person, don't worry about anything. That's usually not what you say to loved ones who are having a problem. You're realistic with them. You talk about the problem as it really exists, but you don't let them exaggerate it. You don't let them catastrophize and turn it into something worse than it really is. The problems of life are bad enough as they are. And it's somewhat ironic that we beat ourselves up and make ourselves feel even worse about what's happened to us than we would have felt by the event itself happening. So it's just a matter of being compassionate and caring and kindness to yourself without minimizing the problems that you may have, because they really are there.
Let's take a caller now. We've got Zane joining us in Madison. Zane, hi.
Hello. It's great to be on there. I love this show. It's super great when you do all these like positive, uplifting moments.
Oh, thank you.
But this last summer, I've been going through basically what this your guest has been talking about. Is I just went super down on myself. I was in a company that felt like they were constantly putting me down, and I personally felt like I was taking all this blame and that I was the, kind of the cause of every issue going on. But they really loved me. Like, any time I brought up, oh, I feel like I'm being underappreciated, they would say, no, you're working really hard. There are some issues, but you are really valued. And it took me a long time this summer to just realize that everyone kind of sees you with your strengths, and you always see yourself as so weak. But it really helps to kind of just, even though there might be bad issues or bad problems, that you have strength, you are a good person, and that you can get through it eventually.
And so, Zane, do you feel like that made a difference in your sense of well-being and happiness when you were able to be nicer to yourself?
Oh, it's mind-opening when you realize, like, okay, I'm strong enough to get through whatever comes my way, basically. That you can always get a, there's always a new way around a different problem. Like, roadblocks always come up, but there's always a over, under, left, or right around the situation.
Great. Well, Zane, thank you so much, and thanks for the kind words about Central Time. And Mark, one takeaway from that call is that Zane was able to change his thinking. He was able to be kind to himself. Is that one of the strengths of this approach, is that it's not too hard to do to learn to be kind to ourselves?
At the most basic level, it's not too hard. And as I listen to Zane talk, it's exactly the kind of thing he would have said to a good friend who was having those same kinds of problems at work. He simply said them to himself. And when you think of it that way, it's not really that hard once you realize you don't have to beat yourself up. That was the turning point for me. It's like a light bulb went off, and I realized I don't have to be as negative toward myself as I have been my whole life. Should you get down on yourself now and then and be critical? Of course. Should you feel badly when you do bad things? Of course. The question is, how badly should you feel? And Zane's learned that he didn't have to feel as badly as he was making himself feel previously.
What do we know about why this is better than focusing on self-esteem? Because that used to be the big thing, as you write about. It used to be there was even, you know, government money going toward increasing people's self-esteem. So why didn't that work as well as this works?
Because once you feel badly about yourself and you have low self-esteem, it's very hard to prop that up artificially. If you really negatively evaluate yourself, it takes a lot of work to evaluate yourself more positively. It's much easier to be kind to yourself, because you can be kind to yourself even if you don't like yourself very much. Even if your self-esteem is low, you can treat yourself well and treat yourself with caring and concern, just like you can treat other people you don't like very well. You don't have to like them and hold them in high esteem. You can still treat them with compassion and caring and kindness, and you can do the same thing for yourself. So self-compassion or self-kindness is more applicable for everybody, because you don't have to start out at a point where you're already feeling good about yourself.
Are we basically talking about self-talk here? So if I've screwed up and I feel bad, I made a bad decision, is it basically the way that I talk to myself, or is it things like treating myself? I'm going to let myself go to bed early and I'm going to have a cup of tea. Which is it? Is it talk or actionable stuff?
I would say it's both. And if you think about how we treat other people who are going through a hard time, we'll say things to them. We'll talk to them in a way that's kind and caring. But we also might suggest we'll go to bed earlier, or let's go out and get a drink and talk about this, or treat yourself to ice cream today. So it's both the way we talk to ourselves in our own mind, and it's the nice things we do to ourselves. This really came out with a student I was working with who had come back from a visit with her grandparents. And they were getting elderly, they were forgetting things, they weren't able to get around as they could. And her grandfather beat himself up awful. He just agonized over not being able to do what he used to do. But her grandmother just naturally had self-compassion. And she would say things like, when I get up and I realize that it's going to be a rough day for me with my arthritis, I treat myself special that day. I take better care of myself, which is exactly, again, what you would do for a friend. You wouldn't just scream at your friend for not forgetting where the car keys are or not being able to walk across the room in a steady way. So it's talk and action.
Let's take another call now. We've got Paul on the line with us from Wausau. Hi, Paul.
Hello. Thank you for the guest. I wanted to say that I've recently gone through a pretty difficult time, and discovering that I have the choice to be kind to myself has been very beneficial. I came about that discovery through some literature, Mindfulness for Beginners and the Four Agreements, and I'd like to get your guest's opinion on mindfulness and the correlation that it has with his literature.
Thank you, Paul, for that question. Is there a correlation between mindfulness, a sort of meditation, and being kind to yourself?
Absolutely, because people who practice mindfulness quiet down a lot of this internal chatter that is often very unkind to us. And in fact, the researcher who first started the study of self-compassion about 10 years ago, it's Dr. Kristen Neff at the University of Texas, explicitly connects self-compassion with the practice of mindfulness, and it's one way to get there. And she says that self-compassionate people are naturally more mindful. They're more attuned to their current situation without judgment and without a lot of self-talk. They just accept the moment as it is, and that's one route. There are other ways to be self-compassionate, but one way is just to accept what's here without a whole lot of internal commentary about it.
Mark Leary is with us now, and he's telling us about why learning to be kind to ourselves can have remarkable benefits according to science. He's a professor of psychology and neuroscience at Duke University, and we want to hear from you on this. Do you find that it's kind of hard to be kind to yourself, or is this something that, like some of our listeners here, you've been working on and you've seen maybe results? Tell us what your experience is. Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can leave your comment on the Central Time Facebook page, and we'll continue our conversation in just a bit. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard, and we're picking up our conversation about how being kind to yourself can be beneficial to your physical and your mental well-being. And we'd love to hear from you on this. Do you find that being kind to yourself is difficult? If you are kind to yourself, was it a difficult transition to make that shift if you're someone who was used to kind of beating yourself up when you did make a mistake? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And you can also email your thoughts to talk@WPR.org. Mark Leary is with us. He's a professor of psychology and neuroscience at Duke University. And we go to our callers now. Katie is first in Madison. Hi, Katie.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call. My first thought when you began the show was I'm 63, and so I was brought up at a time when at home and in school where it was thought that if you did something wrong, raking you over the coals was the correct action to make you feel horrible so you wouldn't do it again. And, as I've grown over the years and had to evolve from that, I do remember having to make that transition from thinking how stupid I was every time I did something wrong and, going into it's not so bad. So, I have this little dialogue going in my head. And now I kind of amuse myself sometimes because I as I'm going through something, I'm thinking of, oh, well, I could be reacting to, this thing that I did and telling myself what an idiot I am. But I'm not, because I realize at my age, it's not the end of the world to make a mistake. I'm going to make a lot of mistakes, and that's okay, and, life will go on. But, my father, I had this talk with him about when I was, as an adult, about that behavior of, screaming at us and saying how terrible we were to make a mistake. And he said that he was brought up in a German household where they thought that brought about excellence.
Interesting, Katie. Yeah, so that's a great point Katie just brought up there. First of all, that's great, Katie, that you were able to make that shift all on your own and figure out how to be kind to yourself. And Mark, is there something to that, that it used to be sort of where the cultural norm that that was how you learned your lessons? You made yourself suffer and feel bad about it. And if you didn't do that, you weren't going to learn the lesson.
Absolutely. And there are plenty of people today who still subscribe to that idea. And I think it's because we're afraid that we're not going to act the way we should. We're going to misbehave, or our kids are going to misbehave unless we really come down on them extremely hard. And, of course, people have to be corrected. There's nothing wrong with parents getting on their kids for, you know, for misbehaving or even making mistakes. The question is, how harsh do you need to be on other people, and how harsh do you need to be for yourself? We did a study a few years ago trying to understand people who actively resist the idea that you should be self-compassionate. Because as I've talked about this over the years, some people say, no, I don't think you should be nice to yourself. You need to come down hard on yourself. You need to be stoic and really set the highest standards. But there's nothing incompatible with having really high standards, but yet finding that sweet spot of how badly do I need to feel in order to keep me on track. And my sense is that most of us go overboard. We assume we have to be much harder on ourselves than we really do, and we can still keep ourselves in line and achieve and do excellent things and be moral people with a lot less chastisement of ourselves, a lot less self-denigration.
Now, in your piece, you talk about how there are both physical and mental and other markers of well-being that are associated with being kind to ourselves. What is the science out there? What can you point to that says, you know, look, here's someone who is healthier and happier because they're practicing this?
Well, in terms of emotion, every study that's been done on self-compassion, and there are dozens now, show that people who are more self-compassionate are happier, they're more satisfied with their lives, they have less anxiety, less depression, less negative emotions in general, they cope better with situations that arise. And I think for most of us, that's what we would like to have in life. We'd like to have a more contented life where everything wasn't such a tragedy and big deal. Bad things are going to happen, to be sure. But if we stop layering on extra self-recrimination and negative emotion, then life will seem better. Physically, there's evidence that anytime you reduce negative emotion and stress, it's better for the body. I mean, there's no question about that. So if you go through life beating yourselves up and upset with yourself chronically, you're going to have worse health than someone who takes things more in stride and has a little more equanimity.
Now, you were participating, you were working with a group of HIV patients, and this idea of self-compassion, and there were some pretty striking differences in these patients and how they worked with themselves. What did you find?
We found not only that the people who were HIV positive, who were more self-compassionate, were coping better with having such a potentially dangerous disease, and they were coping better because they weren't adding, again, those extra layers of shame and self-criticism on top of the fact that they had an illness. But it also seemed to alleviate their concerns about talking about it with other people. So the individuals who were higher in self-compassion talked about being HIV positive more openly with their healthcare providers. They let other people know, because that sense of stigma and shame and self-recrimination just wasn't as high.
Let's take another caller now. We've got Ryan on the line with us in Watertown. Hi, Ryan.
Hi, how's it going?
Good, thanks.
So I've been dealing with this probably since like the early 90s. It's just something that you kind of grow up. Like, some people can get through it by learning to be happier, the positive attitude kind of aspect of it. But, you know, I don't know, growing up in my household, it's more like a one-strike system where you do one bad thing because you want to please people, and then after you do something wrong, you really get down on yourself, and then it just keeps getting worse and worse. And now that I'm in my almost 30s, the attitude or trying to fight these thoughts, if you will, are harder to break. But one of my therapists has really helped me recently with this system that seemed almost childish to me, but it really works.
Can you tell us just briefly what that is?
Yeah. So what it basically is whenever I have a negative thought or start getting down myself, I write these like four categories. There's four squares, if you will, kind of the first off with the negative feeling that I'm having, and then categorize, there's different categories of what attitude it is or what negative feeling it pertains to. And then also, in the third one, kind of defend those positive or try to fight back the negative thoughts with what I did good or what, you know, what could have happened, but I did good kind of thing.
Ryan, thank you so much for sharing that. And so, Ryan, he said these patterns of being tough on himself and having other people be tough on him were really hard to break. But with some therapy, it sounds like some specific techniques, he was able to learn this habit. How hard is it to pick up this habit once you've sort of learned the other one, Mark?
It's a challenge, I can say just personally, to make that sort of switch. The key thing is awareness, and what he really expressed there is being aware and attentive to the times in which you are being harsher on yourself, meaner to yourself than you would be on other people. And just to be alert to that fact and then to stop yourself and say, I wouldn't treat someone else this way. Why would I treat myself this way? Someone once said that if we treated other people the way we treat ourselves in our own heads, that we would be arrested for assault because we are sometimes so negative to ourselves in our heads. It's awareness and monitoring and keeping track of how we're talking to ourselves.
Now, just briefly, we're just about out of time, but I realize you're the researcher here. Have you tried this yourself?
I have struggled with being self-critical my whole life, and I was proud of it. I think a lot of people who are self-critical are proud of, I hold myself to high standards. But when you realize that you're making yourself miserable, then you realize it's not so cool anymore, and you decide, I don't have to be that harsh. I can still have high standards and be a good person without beating myself up.
Well, Mark, thank you so much for joining us and telling us about this today.
Thank you, Veronica.
That was Mark Leary. He's a professor of psychology and neuroscience at Duke University, and he joined us there to talk about how being kind to yourself, science says this, can have a positive effect on your happiness and on your health. Instead of self-esteem, be kind to yourself. That's according to the latest research on the science of positivity.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, we'll learn about a proposed state law that would hold gun-free businesses liable for injuries.
First, genetics is a hot topic, not just in the world of science, but in high-tech business, agriculture, even in our personal lives. As genetic testing becomes more and more common, we're faced with health and ethical questions. Should we get tested for a genetic disease risk? Should our children? Should we modify the genes of the plants and animals we eat? Should we modify human genes?
As big a role as genetics play in the modern world, the gene itself was a recent discovery, with the discovery of DNA answering questions people have been asking for thousands of years and raising new questions, along with a flurry of scientific discovery.
Our next guest traces the past, present, and future of genetic science and his new book. Dr. Siddhartha Mukherjee joins us now. He's assistant professor of medicine at Columbia University and a cancer physician and researcher. He got a lot of attention for his previous book, The Emperor of All Maladies, a biography of cancer. His new book is The Gene, An Intimate History. Dr. Mukherjee, thanks so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Well, after telling the story of cancer in The Emperor of All Maladies, what made you want to tackle the gene?
Well, you know, this book was, in some ways, it was conceived before I thought about the book on cancer. I'm a cancer physician. I treat cancer patients. I'm also a cancer geneticist. And this book was really prompted by the history of mental illness in my family. I have a family history of schizophrenia and bipolar disorder. And over time, I began to realize that there's a strong genetic component. More than one generation, two, perhaps three generations in my family have been affected. But not every person. So there's a kind of terror of knowing but not knowing. And it's a kind of terror that happens in many families, of knowing but not knowing, having a risk but not knowing whether you in particular will have that risk. And, you know, we talked about it as children. We talked about it as adolescents. But when I had my own children and genetics was moving forward so rapidly, it's a question that was unavoidable, you know. How will we imagine these diseases in the future? What happens when we can predict them, not absolutely, you know, not with 100% probability, but with 10% probability? Will we change the way we think about ourselves? Will we start diagnosing ourselves before we have diseases? So all of this sort of begins the gene, and in some ways, again, it's a prequel to The Emperor of All Maladies.
Now, you're looking at the prehistory of the concept of the gene as well. It seems like people knew for a long time, thousands of years, that there's something that's being handed down from parents to children. They look similarly. Some things are similar between parents, children, grandparents. Why was this such a difficult scientific puzzle that we really weren't getting a solid answer until a little bit in the 1800s and into the last century as well?
Well, you know what's interesting is it's very counterintuitive, and I'll give you one example. You know, the example is that we now know that matter is composed of atoms, right? So you keep, you know, if you keep grinding matter, as it were, you get to a point of time where, beyond enormous amounts of energy, you can't really grind matter any further. Molecules and atoms become the units of matter. That's a kind of counterintuitive idea. Most people would have thought that you keep, you know, keep grinding and you keep grinding and keeps going away until it becomes basically vanishes. Genes are also, or were also, a counterintuitive idea. People thought that if you had a red animal and a blue animal, you'd sort of create a purple animal, you know, as a child. A child was a kind of wearing blender, and you just dilute and mix and match all the features of the adult, and you should make a child. But what Gregor Mendel discovered, and this is what's amazing, what's very counterintuitive, is that that's not how information across the biological world works. It works through pixels. They're pixels of information, and these pixels of information move from parents to children, and they get mixed up. We get various combinations, and that's why, you know, some of our features are different. These pixels of information intersect with chance, they intersect with the environment, they intersect with each other, and that's ultimately that creates you and me and ourselves. That's an incredible solution that was reached over, again, the last 150-odd years.
Well, let's tackle a really basic question with, I think, a really complicated answer. What is a gene?
A gene is a unit of information that is transmitted from cell to cell or from organism to organism. It specifies a feature, some feature, some activity, some function, such that that function is actualized in the organism or in the animal. It usually works by making a message called RNA, and often that RNA is made into a protein. But basically, a gene is a unit of information that specifies a particular function or feature in an organism. One gene can specify many functions. One function can be specified by many genes. But the truth remains is that the gene is a unit of information that is transmitted from one organism to the next.
Talking to Dr. Siddhartha Mukherjee about his new book, The Gene, An Intimate History, looking at the past, present, and future of genetic science. Dr. Mukherjee, I think there was a stage early on in the world of genetics where, at least in the public eye, it was really simple. It was like Gregor Mendel's peas. There's a gene here that tells how round the pea is going to be, how long the pod is going to be, how green it'll be, that sort of thing, and then that translates out into what grows. The reality, for the most part, is way more complicated, isn't it?
The reality, as we now know, is more complicated. You know, Mendel was successful in doing what he was doing because he could isolate these features. But in humans, features that we think are, you know, simple, even simple features, the color of your eye, the kind of hair you have, how tall or short you are, is governed by not one gene but many genes and the interactions between genes and environments and chance. So what seems simple, on one hand, of course, it's very simply sort of information moving from parents to children, can become very complicated. I often give a simple example, and that's why it's important to know this, this story. The simple example is, imagine five colored sheets of transparent paper, you know, blue, white, green, yellow, purple. Now, if you overlap these sheets of paper in different combinations, you can get every spectrum of color, and it would seem that you can create any spectrum of color. But what's important is that at no point of time did you ever blend, the sheets of transparent paper remained the same. It was their overlap that really created all these different spectra of color. That's what's happening to some extent in the genetic world. It's overlaps between various genes, gene variants, that are creating the variation in features, and there's a role of environment and there's a role of chance. Why is all of this important? It's important because if all of a sudden you could tamper with or you could change one of those transparent sheets of paper, you could change the color, you could change its size, you could eliminate it, say, then all of a sudden you can now begin to produce different spectra of of what happens afterwards. And that's the kind of prospect that becomes very simultaneously very tantalizing and also very scary. And that's where we are now. We're now at a position where we can read the human genome, we can sort of predict very loosely some features, not all features, but some features about our future, and we can change parts of the human genome, at least in cells. The analogy that I like to give is that, you know, the human genome, genes, they have only four letters. There's only four letters in the alphabet. It's A, C, T, G. And if you were to look at the human genome, it would correspond to 66 full sets of the Encyclopedia Britannica. So you'd walk into a giant room, a huge library, and every wall would be lined with an Encyclopedia Britannica. And if you took out one of these volumes, it would just read A, C, T, G, G, C, 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 T, G, C, C, and so forth. Totally inscrutable to you and me. And yet, from that, an organism can build you, it can build me, it can build the commonalities that we have, and also the differences that we have. So that's the first thing that we need to contend with, that this information can be so rich that it can create these incredibly complex organisms out of that ACTG code. But number two is that now we can, in cells and potentially in embryos, but certainly in cells, we can change the code. We can go into that Encyclopedia Britannica, that 66 full sets of the Encyclopedia Britannica, look at one word, and change the word from, one letter of that word to another letter of the word. ACTGCCC, we can change to AGTCCCC. And that technology is new. We can do it in human cells. We can do it in other animal cells. And that really changes the stakes of this whole equation, the stakes of this whole puzzle.
If we can find the part of that code that spells out, say, one specific change and alteration that raises a risk of, say, a particular type of cancer, is it possible that we can change that code, make it much less likely that a person would get that particular type of cancer?
Well, let's talk in specifics. I mean, you know, we now know that there are certain genes that are, that if you inherit those genes, your risk of cancer increases. So, could you in principle go and change that gene in a human embryo? In principle, you could. In practice, it would be virtually impossible now. But the pieces of technology that allow us to do this in principle have now been invented. In China, about a year ago, there was an experiment to change a gene that encodes for a blood disease in a human embryo. They were non-viable human embryos, so ultimately the experiment was naturally aborted. But of course, the proof of principle is already there. Could you change a gene in a particular human cell, in a living human? Perhaps you can. I'll give you one more example. Could you change it in an embryonic stem cell, derive sperm and eggs from those cells, and thereby introduce a genetic change in the human germline, the human genome line? Yes, again, in principle, you could. So all of a sudden, things that were fantastical ideas in terms of manipulating heredity are becoming real. They're becoming real in other animals or for other animals. We can do this in other animals. We can do it in insects. And potentially, if we could do that in other animals, we could do it in humans.
We're talking to Dr. Siddhartha Mukherjee. He's telling the story of the gene and the latest in genetic science. His new book is The Gene, An Intimate History.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Have you done a genetic test, maybe to look for diseases or to trace your ancestry? Would you want to know if you were genetically predisposed to a disease or maybe if your child was? And what do you think of the idea of genetically modifying humans, and how do we begin to do it ethically? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up the conversation in just a minute. This is Central Time.